Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend show. This weekend show, we're focusing more big picture on these markets. We're going to bring on two of our favorite, let's call them generalist investors and traders, to try to make sense of what really are choppy markets right now. It seems like everything is off of its highs, all-time highs, and trading in ranges or even in slight downtrends. So I realize a lot of this is being driven by geopolitics, which really muddies the water. But fact of the matter is, some of these fading moves in markets started even before this Iranian war. So a lot for us to talk about and hopefully make some sense of where some opportunities are in what are, again, very choppy markets. We're kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies. Rick writes the institutional newsletter called Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, check out the In the Know Trader website. I'll post a link in the show notes. Rick has two products there, a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report and a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. Rick, let's just start off big picture. When we have these sort of choppy markets, it does seem like a lot of people leaning more negative, if not simply confused at where direction lies, and geopolitics driving markets. It seems like everyone now is simply ignoring any sort of economic data. What do you do as an investor in this environment?
Well, Corey, for the last, I don't know, 3-4 months or so, I've been slowly raising cash. We use a bunch of different models to help actually do what is said is impossible to do on the street, which is time the market. And yet in my 40 plus year career on the street, I am known as one of the best market timers. And one of the models we use from a guy named developed by Tom DeMark, Sequential, and a sister model combo, there are 14 upside exhaustion signals on the daily chart for the spiders, the SPY, and that's by far a record amount of them. And they started showing up in, I think the first one was in October. You'd have to get and stay above something like 695.5 in order to stop that out. And that's within a point or two of the all-time high now since October, which was in February. Or maybe actually late January, I think the high was. But subsequent to that, another 13 signals showed up. And I've been telling clients for months now, you know, we've gone sideways. It's been pure trading range, but I've been using strength in individual names and or sectors to just lighten up because I've never seen anything like it in the S&P. To have 14 signals not stopped out is, besides record breaking, it implies a significant amount of you're very, very late in the game, kind of like, you know, you're in the ninth inning, you should not be looking for this game to last hours more type thing. And whether a combination of the war with Iran now and just market dynamics, we have come off, if we were to close right now where we are trading, you know, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, a little after noon. If we close where we are now, which is kind of, let's call it 669 handle in spiders, this would be the lowest close since just a couple days after the November bottom was put in. And that November bottom was the one that led to what is now the all-time high. So it's an important bottom. That was down near 650. We have four or five lows going back to September between 650 and 655. The 200-day moving average is 658 and change. So we may very well be heading down there to test those lows. Interestingly, and most people wouldn't catch this unless they are kind of futures traders, and you know the bulk of the public isn't, nor do they look at S&P futures other than just to get an indication of where the market may open each day. Sunday night when the market was getting crushed, S&P futures sold down to their 200-day moving average. The cash S&P never got there on Monday because the market bounced and the overnight low was far lower than where the market got to on Monday. Spiders did not reach there either. And in Monday night's report, I said to clients in the daily tip sheet, I am concerned that futures got there and the cash S&P and the spiders did not. That makes me think that they will likely get to their 200 days before we even have a chance of bottoming. The one possibly good thing I'm seeing now, and this is again related to a DeMarc model, is that today is the ninth day in a row that we're going to close less than the close from 4 days prior. So that's not nine consecutive lower closes. It's just each day you're looking back to the close 4 days ago. And as long as the close is beneath the close from 4 days ago for 9 days in a row, you often get a trading bounce from there. So we may get a bounce off of, today going into tomorrow's option expiration. However, given where all the volume's been done over the last several months, we're still beneath the bulk of the heaviest volume point, so which implies trapped buyers overhead. And you've got to be a pretty darn committed buyer at this point to not sell into some strength if it comes in order to reduce exposure. Also, for the first time in the entire move off of last April's bottom, 4 days ago, the 50-day moving average started turning down, and it's been down each day since then. So you now have a rising 200-day, but a negatively sloped 50-day, and that would imply that at least for now, the 50-day probably caps rallies. That's now at 687 in the spiders. So right now, I have no reason to think we just simply turn around, go up, and make new all-time highs the way the talking head bulls on business television are constantly telling you. I think there's still a decent chance we take out Monday's low. We test the 200 day. We maybe even test that 650, 655 quadruple bottom that we had from last fall. And you're in a much iffier environment. Obviously, the war changes a lot here. Energy prices, you're talking now almost $100 oil again. And the headlines are going to move crude oil prices every day. And there's not much you can do about that other than hopefully not be underweight energy. We went overweight last fall and we had some drawdown in our overweight call, but it has turned around and worked out very nicely. So in the big picture, all you can do is go look through your portfolio, look at non-performing names. And figure out whether or not these are names you still want to hold. Where are they relative to the highs they've made? Are you 5% off a high or are you 30% off of a high? And if you're 30%, you got to ask yourself, A, do I still want to own something that I'm clearly, well, that's way off the highs, but you also have to figure out how much you're potentially down. Is it 30% off the highs, but you're long from even lower than that? Or did you buy it sometime in the last 6 months and now it's 30% off the highs? And is it just not a stock to own? And people are so hesitant to sell out of things. But my theory is take losses, try not to have them get and accumulate. Anything beyond 15, 20% was clearly kind of a bad decision. And losses offset gains. So if you're taking gains and getting out of stuff too, there's nothing wrong with taking it, assuming it's in a taxable account. There's nothing wrong with taking losses. Yeah, it's finally you're admitting you're wrong, something you probably knew 10% ago, and just didn't bother getting out of, hoping that it was going to come back. So I look at taking losses as just part of the game. Any professional tells you need to readily take losses. It's just part of the game. And those who don't suffer with major drawdowns in bad investments. And to me, it ends up being very costly over time.
Well, some great points raised there, Rick, as far as managing the losses with the gains and washing those out, using them to your advantage, admitting you're wrong, and redeploying that capital. In this kind of a market, you said you've raised more cash because you've eased up into the strength. What would make you get back in after you've seen some of this corrective move play through? And or would you even be tactically shorting some markets if you expect this weakness?
I'm not going short, honestly. I still believe in the idea that over time stocks add value. So it's not that I've never gone short, but up until 2 weeks ago, I would tell you the economy is doing pretty decently. There's some stuff going on now in the U.S. 10-year that's a little concerning. We're up to what, 4.25, something like that, 4.25%. And I really didn't think when we got down to 3.96 a week or two ago, I guess it's probably 2 weeks ago, I said that at that point, I wouldn't have any strong reason to think that we would get above 4.2 again. And in the last week or so, I've kind of changed my tune, and we didn't get above it really till today or yesterday. But the last decline to, let's just say, round numbers, 3.95%, besides it being the low from like a year ago, so we again went to the bottom of the range and bounced. When I did some longer term work, I realized that 3.95 was also the uptrend line from the test of the all-time low. So you can't really draw a good trend line from the all-time low, which was 40 basis points or 38 basis points, something like that. But the bounce from there and the test of it, I think it was in 2020, that low connected to whatever the next major cyclical bottom was, that major uptrend line, like the uptrend line in yields, was 3.95 last week. So we bounced on not just a test from a year ago, but the uptrend line from the lows. That kind of makes me feel like I don't really now, I don't have, and not only are we above 4.2, but I don't have the conviction of a couple of weeks ago that yields would finally break. I kind of think that we're getting a different story here. And the chance of rate cuts is dramatically lower now than it was just a couple of weeks ago. You had easily two cuts priced in with an 80% chance or so of the first one coming in June. That's now gone. And they've pushed off a second cut until December now. If you look at Fed Fund futures, you can see this. So you may not be getting rate cuts this year, as so many people were saying. And the fixed income market, to me, is kind of giving you a clue that all you can really do now is simply trade that market because the moves don't last. We continue to be somewhat range bound with, I'd say, 4.4 to 3.95 right now is the bigger range. And I'm a little concerned about what the bond market is telling us now as far as the implication of global growth and, perhaps upped odds of recession coming.
That's what a lot of people are afraid of, but people have been afraid of a recession for the last couple years. And yeah, it's interesting to see the moves in the bond market and rate cuts coming off the table. But Rick, let's talk about the big elephant in the room. I want you to dive a little bit more into the oil sector. It's driven all by geopolitics. No one knows how long this war is going to last for, but it is very impactful to energy markets. You used to be a commodities trader. What's going on in oil? How would you play it?
The simple answer is you don't. Unless you want to be up all day and all night watching, because the moves are huge every day, you don't play it. You can play the stocks, you can be overweight energy, that's fine, but you don't play the oil market per se. You play the implications of the oil market and what's going on there as far as the potential for slower growth. This affects everyone. Even if you don't own a car, you go, well, I don't, I live in Manhattan. I don't own a car. Well, yeah, the price of oil affects everything because the building you live in is paying more. It's going to cost you more in rent. The office building you work in has higher charges. So the company that you work for has more cost. It's going to come down to the bottom line and affect profits, which ultimately affects what they pay you, et cetera. This is a global event. And the implications of what a spike in oil from a triple bottom at 55 just back in December was the third time we got there to now 90, 100, 110, $120 oil is huge. So Even traders, I know. I mean, one of my best friends, traded oil professionally in the pits in a career of it. I think that you, unless you want to be glued to your screen every moment of every day, you don't trade oil, but you certainly look at what the implications are for it.
Well, Rick, let's talk about the oil stocks then, because the implications for the oil stocks are probably better margins, better revenues, possibility of hedging. But if you look at XLE just as a placeholder for the bigger producers, I'm surprised at how strong it was all year long. I mean, starting in January, XLE just really took off. And that was when oil was in the 60s and boring and sideways, and it just kept going higher and higher. Now we had the Venezuela thing along with Iran, so it's been a wild year already. But what do you make of how strong the producers have already been? If you look at some of the biggest ones, the Exxons and ConocoPhillips, they've been strong too. And now we have these higher prices. But it's interesting, it stopped going up when the prices spiked. It seems like they even rolled over a little bit recently. What do you make of this action in the oil stocks versus the oil price?
Well, look, I mean, take something like the ETF XOP, which is the S&P 500 Oil and Gas Index ETF. If you historically look back over the last few years, we are close to highs from 2022 and 2024. So naturally, you could expect some selling up here on profit take. If you look at the low from last April, it got down to about, I don't know, 100. The prior low from 2022 was 110. So you took it out by 10%, but in a matter of just, it was a 2 week move that broke that 110 level. You washed out longs against there, and then this thing came all the way back. And now you're at the high end of the range. This week, just again referencing DeMarc models, this is the ninth week in a row that the close is going to be above. Let's assume tomorrow doesn't fall apart. The close is going to be above the close from 4 weeks prior. So we know this is a potential resting point and possible pullback point. In 2024, the top was made on the same weekly nine count. That was also a full sequential upside exhaustion signal, which in the industry, we know this as a 13 count. And on the current chart, the 13 count came in 2 weeks ago, but before war. So you're somewhat stretched in a bigger up move that runs everything to the upside. This thing has a target, let's say between 195 and 200. So on a percentage basis, that's what 30, it's still, I don't know, 15, 18% higher than where we are. But the thing is, what these models are really helpful for is if you don't have a position on, to first get long now implies tremendous risk relative to any other time. And it's not just because we're against prior highs, it's that these timing models also suggest that. So something, this thing's trading at like 168 now, you could be at 150 next week if something changes in the perception of what oil is going to do. So if you're not already in them, now is a hard time in my mind to first get in them. And it doesn't mean it couldn't work, but it does mean that the risk of drawdown is much higher than it's been in quite some time. And that you'd have to want to live with that extra risk for the hope that this thing plays out further to the upside.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Any sort of ceasefire could really turn this back down. Oil was generally under pressure for the last number of years. 3 years started to rebound before this war, and now, well, it spiked higher, but boy, oh boy, has that been volatile. Just curious, Rick, in terms of other commodities, especially precious metals, do you see a safety trade here? Because gold has continued to do well. It's not back to all-time highs, but you look at a daily chart and it just keeps jumping or bouncing off of the 50-day moving average. It's a long way away from any moving average on the weekly or monthly chart. But is there a safety trade into gold or into anything else that you're seeing during this geopolitical kind of turmoil?
I do think gold will still be a safety instrument to own. And I've owned gold for years. I've owned silver since I first bought SLV. I think it was 2011. So my answer is yes. What I'd like to see, and not for my own personal P&L purposes, perspective, but from just, I'd love to see a washout in gold that just gave people a better chance to get in than continuously chasing after it higher and higher. 2 weeks ago, the GLD chart, so that's the ETF, the weekly GLD chart, had again one of these upside exhaustion signals. Now, they have not been very good in the last couple of years because gold has just been in a phenomenal up move that has very little pullback. I've trimmed a bit of my gold miners, and I think I'm trying to remember. I did trim some gold in the fall, and in hindsight, not a good trim. But I don't mind taking profits on something, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It means the rest of the position is still working, which is why I often trim in pieces and not do everything as all or none. I think it's still a safe trade. I'm just trying to think, how much of the public is in it yet as compared to what percent of the public owns Nvidia and Mag 7 type names. It doesn't compare, so gold is underinvested that way. But over time, do I still think gold is going higher and perhaps decently higher? I do, because I don't think you can trust much else. Crypto's telling you can't necessarily trust that. And of course, it's had 50% drawdowns before, like it did recently. But gold has been working. And at this point, let's just put Bitcoin as the leader of crypto. Bitcoin is not. If you loan Bitcoin at 20 grand and now it's trading 70 grand, you're fine. But it was $125,000, in the fall or last summer. I don't remember when exactly it was. But, it just gave back 50%. I think gold is something you can touch, you can store it, and I think still the public will shy away from crypto after this particular drawdown and use the precious metals more so. And gold ultimately is going to be the winner in all those.
Well, and Rick, we can even see crypto companies like Tether with Tether Gold buying massive amounts of gold, more than small central banks are, and central banks still keep buying gold to put it on their balance sheet. So you're seeing that monetary use of the metal. Now, silver is a little bit different animal in that it's more industrial than precious, but it's been on such a wild move, and we have a lot of investors that listen to our show, Rick, that are in silver or silver stocks. It got up to 121 on the futures price as far as silver, then dove down to 64, and then since then has kind of channeled sideways in a whipsaw motion. We're in the mid-80s as we record this. What do you make of silver? Did it top out there? Was that the end? Or there's this big bookends now between 121 and 64. So are we just in the middle of that range, ready to break one way or the other?
Yeah, so the same thing for silver. I wrote about it in gold, but it probably implied silver. Although, so if you look at the day that made the all-time high, 2 days later, gold had sold off $500. And that's been the range since. We haven't gotten to the top, and you didn't really get to the bottom. Silver did take out the low from 2 days prior, about a week after that, but then it's moved up since. And it precisely bottomed silver futures on the bottom of its upward moving Ichimoku cloud chart. And so that I actually added there, and I've already since kicked it out simply because it's also gotten another sell signal along the way, an upside exhaustion signal at the end of February. So I think I paid 65 and change for, well, that let me see, that was in futures. I'm trying to remember what, here, let me just take a quick look at SLV. SLV, I bought it also 65 and kicked it out, I think, at 80. And or 81, and that to me was, that was good enough for a quick trade. I'm still long my silver from 2011 in the 20s handle. And if we get up to SLV, probably the upper 80s, I'll probably kick some out there too. It's, this is, as you said, it's an industrial metal. It's going to be more sensitive to the economy, to the general direction of stock market. And I think over time it goes higher, but the downside risks are pretty big too. And silver is more, I used to trade silver in the pit for a short amount of time when I was on COMEX. And the thing about silver is it can trade on air. I don't know any other market that moves so fast as silver when, especially to the downside, when it decides it no longer wants to be going up. So that's the, the only warning here is that if you look at SLV and where the 200-day or the 200, yeah, the 200-day is down at $50. We're trading 77, so you're over 50% above the price of the 200-day. There's just always this downside risk. We're hanging either side of the 50-day moving average right now, but it has not been able to test the top of its cloud recently. So that's also a little bit concerning. But in the last week or so, it keeps playing with the bottom side, and if it can't really break the bottom side, it will go back up to the top side, and that gets you the upper 80s.
Okay. Well, that gives us something to watch for, but that sounds more like what you would say we should be trading or looking at that market. What about the gold or silver stocks? If we look at GDX or even SIL, again, kind of choppy charts. To me, GDX still looks better than the SIL chart, but both are in a way range bound. So anything change in that assessment of the underlying gold or silver stocks?
So let's say SIL has a double top, just shy of 120, the one in January, and then 2 weeks ago it got close to that again, came back. It's right now on its 50-day, positively sloped 50-day. There is some support right here, and didn't quite get to the bottom of the range. I'd say right now you want to see this thing hold $90. If it breaks $90, let's see. Well, I'm going to take it back. I'm going to say 88-ish for the next couple of days, then up to about 90 a week from now. Otherwise, from there, 83 would be next. And beyond that, you've got 78. So you're in a trading range now. It's holding the bottom end, but I think bulls don't want to see 88 break anytime in the next week or so.
Rick, do you have any thoughts on copper, which has been getting up to close to $6 a pound a number of times and then diving back down below it, but it's kind of toggling on either side, which is a strong price for it historically. But if you look at COPEX, COPX, the bigger producers, it's had a pretty good rip. And they were ripping again, it's like XLE. These stocks were ripping higher even when copper was getting punished from all the tariff stuff last year. So when you look at copper, it's been volatile. How are you looking at it or the copper stocks?
So COPX, today's low, and the low a couple of days ago too, bounced on the bottom of its cloud. It's an upward sloping cloud that's been a bullish market. So you came down to, important support. The heaviest volume in the last month was down at $80. We're trading 80.60. So as of right now, that came from, let's see, today's Thursday. So that was Monday. Some probably big institutional seller sold and dumped out. And the fact that we're trading above that now is actually good. It opens the door for move up to 88. But you really don't want to see a close underneath, I'd say 78 and a half right now. It's pretty oversold for it's about the most oversold it's been, let's say in MACD terms. You have to go back to April of last year to be this oversold, even though it's minimally off the high. And in the front page of that report that you get from me each week, where I go through markets, copper is rated, I'm pretty sure I'm neutral, both short term and longer term.
So, Rick, it sounds like a lot of the play in commodities, or at least these big commodities, precious metals and even copper, which don't need to move together, is a wait and see. Is that fair to say for a lot of the commodity complex then?
Well, energy's made a big move, and now you got to see how much follow through it gets. Metals have made a huge move. I don't really look at meats anymore. So the other, I guess, part, the other part is the ag side. And the ag side's also been in a trading range for quite some time. I'd give a slight edge to that piece of commodities, perhaps being the next one to move.
Rick, do you follow uranium at all? Because we have a lot of people that invest in URA or URNM or individual stocks, but any thoughts on, just if you pulled them up, technically URA or URNM as far as uranium equities?
Yeah, that's actually we have a position in that in the weekly tactical trader report. I think we're still in it. Today's Thursday, so I'll be writing a new one this afternoon. This also uranium has a double. The ETF has a double top just north of 60, and so it's range bound. And if it pulls back down now, you could get down to, I'd say, 40, unless the upward slope 50-week moving average ends up being a low. I'd say the door's open here for this to. If you've got a double top, look at the lowest low in between the double top, and that's often what you're going to come back down to test as the bottom end of the range. That particular number in the URA chart is 39.95 was the low in November when everything sold off and bottomed in November. And right now, starting at about two or three weeks, the bottom of the weekly chart's at 40. So, similar price, I'd say that's where this could potentially go.
Okay. Rick, I want to go back to the cryptocurrencies. You mentioned how Bitcoin, about 50% off of its highs, or it had pulled back 50%, a little over 50% when it was about 126,000 down to 60,000. This is not uncommon for Bitcoin. The sell-offs actually just over the last 5, 6 years sometimes been in the 70 plus percent range. Curious though, and I'm not a huge Bitcoin person, but when you do see a market like this pull back that quickly, and in all fairness, I've read some interesting stories about other countries, even my country, Canada, issuing or at least testing the blockchain by issuing some bonds through tokenization. Curious your outlook for Bitcoin now that it has pulled back 50% and for the last little while is actually just kind of flatlined, might be building a base.
Yeah, it could be. Look, when you sell off 50% and that low holds, and that low was just above the 200-week, I'm sorry, yeah, the 200-week moving average for Bitcoin, it was just a tad beneath where we got to about 6 weeks ago on the low. Sure, I mean, it certainly could stage a rally. The thing is, when you have something that's considered an investment and it regularly sells off 30, 40, 50% as part of its cyclical moves, that's to me not an investment. That's a speculative trade, and there's nothing wrong with doing it, but understand it's not an investment. I don't know anybody who walks into an investment and says, I have no problem with watching this fall 50% over my ownership time period. Would you do that with a stock? Would you buy a $100 stock and say, hey, it's fine if it goes to 50? I just think, in 5 years or 10 years, it's going to be 150 or 200. Most people don't do that, and they shouldn't. That's not an investment. That's a speculative trade, and that goes in a different category of your whole portfolio.
Great comments there, Rick. And yeah, I think if most people had a stock that went down 50%, they would feel a lot differently about it. But for some reason in crypto, people tolerate the volatility, but it is more speculative. Well, another area that we should touch on briefly is international markets. There's been more interest in international markets, sometimes emerging market funds, but also just playing ETFs for specific countries. Any thoughts there as far as internationally?
Yeah, so this year, it's the first time we've seen in a while that international is beating U.S. markets. One of the key proxies I use is the ETF ACWX. It's the ACWI All World Index exclusive of the U.S. market. That peaked about 3 weeks ago, and it's pulled back. It also peaked on that on a DeMarc sequential signal, which implied much higher than normal risk at the time. But I think we could very well be in for more than a very short period, which is only traditionally that non-US outperforms US. I think this could last longer, partially because right now Mag 7 collectively looks like dead money. And that's what drove our market and got, it's where the capitalization is. It's what made the US be so powerful the last several years. And I look at those charts and I kind of see it as dead money. It's not bad. There's nothing wrong with owning those names. You own them individually or own them collectively through the ETF for the Mag 7. The ticker is MAGS. But right now, sometimes, you look, it's pretty rare that they all do the same thing on the same day unless the market made a very strong, let's call it 100-point S&P move in one direction. It's rare that they are all going in the same direction at the same time. And so I think there's rotation amongst those seven names in the institutional community and a little bit on the public side. But being that those still represent over a third of the whole S&P, just seven names out of the 500, then I think you could see some extended period of time that non-US does better than US. And I think also emerging markets probably are likely to do well and continue to do well. So I'm long those two in my own account, and I plan on holding those.
Okay, Rick, let's go full circle then. I remember when you used to write that 7-Eleven report where you would pick the individual sectors within the S&P. We talked big picture about the S&P. We've talked commodities, which do seem to be holding up better than some of these sectors. You just said the Mag 7 looks like dead money. Curious what sectors you would be picking right now. Software stocks have sold off hard. People are trying to pick a bottom in that. Industrials were doing well, but everything seems to have rolled over. So what sectors would you pick right now if you had to put money down?
I tell you, my favorite sector right now is probably utilities. And still, believe it or not, staples are doing well. All the cyclical sectors are doing well. The Mag 7 ones and on the defensive side, healthcare, not doing great. And financials are kind of the worst. And with interest rates moving up right now, that's kind of, interesting. You've got obviously some issues in the private credit space, and Morgan Stanley's down another $5 today. Goldman's getting hit. There are some issues there, so I would still avoid those. And as of right now, I have little incentive to go after tech, consumer discretionary, or what am I missing? Communication services. The three that make up the Mag 7 names, XLC, XLK, and XLY. I have no particular reason right now to go there. So it's the general cyclical sectors, the broadening of the market, the fact that, RSP, which is the ticker for the S&P equal weight ETF as compared to the SPDRs, it's done better. There's a real broadening of the market. And as of yet, I don't have any real particular reason to come back into Mag 7 names and think that they're going to again be the new price leader. So I'd stick with cyclical sectors, the broadening of the market, and avoid XLF. And right now, maybe even healthcare. It had such a great run. It's still doing okay, but I would put that on the kind of cyclical slash defensive side. I'd say XLF and XLV are the two that I just don't see a reason to be in yet.
All right, Rick, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you so much for spending time with us, sharing your thoughts on really every sector that we like to talk about, and even some extra ones. Again, you want to follow along with Rick, best thing for you to do is search In the No Trader or click those links on our website, in your podcast player, or on our YouTube channel. Again, Rick Bensinger, President of Bensinger Investment Strategies. Rick, great chatting with you today. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back, continuing more on the technical and broad look at these markets in many different ways.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.